This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Throughout the week, we've been featuring a series of interviews on the body and the mind. We conclude the series today with an examination of the minds of violent criminals. Be aware that our program will include several stories about gruesome crimes. Serial killers and serial rapists tend to be the most bewildering, personally disturbing, and most difficult to catch of all violent criminals, according to John Douglas. He's the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. He's the author of the bestseller Mindhunter and a book about the Unabomber. Douglas was the model for the FBI agent Jack Crawford in the novel and film Silence of the Lambs. He worked on such cases as the Atlanta child murders, the Tylenol murders, the Son of Sam, and the Unabomber. Douglas pioneered the approach of identifying a serial killer by finding his signature. The signature is those clues the killer leaves at the scene of the crime, clues that reflect the killer's personality. Now, you developed your technique for profiling serial killers and tracking them down by interviewing serial killers and serial rapists in California prisons and studying them, getting to know them. Let's look at one of the people who you interviewed and some of the things you learned by talking with him that seemed to be fairly typical of other serial killers as well. Mm-hmm. I was thinking we could look at Ed Kemper.
Okay.
And now, who is he?
Ed Kemper was extremely bright, 145 IQ. He was 6'9". He weighed 300 pounds. When he was 14 years old, he killed his grandparents and called his mom up and told mom, hey, guess what? I killed Grandma and Grandpa, and I won't be going back next summer visiting them. And so they arrested, of course, Ed Kemper, but they put him in a mental institution, and then they released him at about 18 to 19 years of age. They put him back into society, and I sarcastically will say they cured him. Well, they didn't cure him. He was the victim of a severe amount of child abuse and neglect at the hands of his mother, so they put him back in the custody of his mother. And he was what I would call asexual, asocial. He would have wanted to date, and his mother, who worked at a university, said, hey, listen, you're nothing but a bum. No matter what you do or grew up to be, you'll never be able to date these girls. So in his mind, he said, well, I'm gonna show her. So he would pick up hitchhikers around the campus. He had a university sticker on his car, so the girls, these unsuspecting hitchhikers, felt safe. He would get either one or two girls in the car. It didn't make any difference because he already rigged the door handle when they got into the vehicle. They were unable to open the door once they realized that they were going not in the place where they wanted to go. He then took them out, would kill them, would decapitate them, cut their hands off to delay identification, but then would take the heads back to his house, bury the heads outside of his mother's window, and just would fantasize about at times even having sex with these girls, although he had no sex with them, but really was trying to get back at and was getting back at mom. The case ended finally after killing seven co-eds. He killed his mother, decapitated her, and put her head on a kitchen table, and basically was kind of chewing her out for the ill treatment that he received throughout his childhood. He then fled, was arrested in Colorado. I think what I learned from an individual like this, it just kind of reinforced the fact that most of the offenders who I interviewed have all come from these dysfunctional families, almost without exception. This is not to say if you come from a dysfunctional family, you're going to grow up to be a violent offender, but of the violent offenders who I've interviewed, they've all come from this particular background.
No, I think you also found out that when this guy was young, he'd torture animals.
Right, and that's what you come in, we call the homicidal triangle, which includes animal cruelty, arson, and enuresis, which is bedwetting. And the bedwetting continues up to 8, 10, 12 years of age. The animal cruelty begins right around kindergarten, 6, 7, 8 years of age. And arson usually starts at about that time. So when you're a parent or if you're a school teacher and you see these characteristics, the odds are very, very high that that this person is going to grow up to be a violent offender. In fact, I've always said that school teachers are probably some of your best profilers because they see these things, these traits, these characteristics very, very early on.
I guess it doesn't shock me that a serial killer would have tortured animals when he was young or started fires when he was young. The bedwetting, I don't really understand.
The bedwetting it has to do more of an emotional problem, and not a physiological problem with them. And it's from the abuse that they're receiving at the hands of the parents. And so it's an emotional element.
You've interviewed so many serial killers. Have you found that they ever have any remorse or any sense of what it is they've actually done?
No, they'll fake it, and I'll go along with it. You'll see tears streaming down their face, but the tears are for themselves, that their life is ruined. They could care less about the victims and the families, the lives that they've ruined, but they cry for themselves, and they'll cry post-arrest, or they'll cry when you interview them in jail. But if you would polygraph them after the crime, that's why they're very difficult to show deception, because they feel the crimes they committed are justified. So there's nothing there.
John Douglas is the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. We'll hear more from him in the second half of our show. Some violent crimes today seem so brutal, so pointless, and the perpetrators are so lacking in remorse, it's almost hard to think of them as human. How did they get that way, we wonder? That's what Dr. James Gilligan has been trying to understand. Dr. James Gilligan is a psychiatrist who has spent 25 years working with murderers and other violent criminals. He's the former medical director of the Bridgewater State Hospital for the Criminally Insane and former director of mental health for the Massachusetts prison system. He also directed the Center for the Study of Violence at Harvard Medical School. In his recent book, Violence, he describes what he's learned about the causes of violent behavior and how to prevent it. He told me that one of the characteristics many murderers have in common is that they think of themselves as dead, the living dead.
Well, I have spoken with literally thousands of murderers over the last 25 years, and I can tell you that almost all of them have described at one time or another that they felt they had died at some point in the past, often an identifiable point. And what they mean by that is that they literally lost the capacity for feelings of aliveness, for feelings of any sort. And I mean both physical sensations and emotions. I'm talking about, the way they've described this to me, it varies from one person to another, but it all comes down to basically the same thing. Many people have told me they don't have the capacity for physical sensations. They feel like they are dead, numb, as if their bodies were filled with ropes and cords rather than nerves and blood vessels, that they feel empty inside. One person told me he felt like food that was decomposing. They've told me they've used terms like zombie, vampire, robot to describe themselves. I asked one man, for example, and many people at different times, why they killed somebody. The answer that came back that shocked me but fascinated me, because I thought we could learn something from it, I think of one particular man now, said, I did it because I wanted to see if I would have feelings.
Does the act of murder make someone feel more alive when he's felt dead?
In most cases, no. In most cases, it is self-defeating. Men have told me they don't feel anything. They say, does that mean I'm not alive or I'm not human, that I don't even feel remorse or guilt? And I think that is one reason why the rate of self-murder or suicide is hundreds of times to even thousands of times greater among people who commit murder than it is among the general public. When they find that committing murder doesn't enable them to feel alive, then they choose to do away with themselves.
But one of the reasons why they do murder somebody is as a test to see, will this make me feel, will I feel anything if I murder this person?
I think that's true. I wouldn't at all say that that is something that all murderers are consciously aware of at the time they do it. I mean, I'm not saying they would all put it in words that way. Mm-hmm. One of the problems murderers have is they're so oriented toward action that they don't customarily put things into words and reflect on them. I'm telling you what I have learned from sitting down afterwards and spending often years with these people, exploring their psyches and trying to learn what, could conceivably have led them to do the horrible things that they've done, to commit the atrocities they've committed.
Does this help explain why it seems that so many murderers have absolutely no empathy for their victims?
Yes. I think, first of all, the absence of feelings makes it impossible to empathize with others. The fact that they themselves feel dead means they can't understand that other people, in fact, are alive and have feelings. I'm talking about men, for example, who mutilate themselves after they have mutilated others. Once they get into prison, one thing that keeps the emergency rooms in prisons busy every single day of the week is the prison inmates who mutilate themselves in ways that are just as horrible as the ways they mutilate their victims. They do this because they don't have physical feelings at the time they do it. They'll tell me they're anesthetized at the time that they... Well, they do things that are, frankly, too terrible to even go into over the air, frankly. Horrendous things. They do it because they don't have feelings. And if they don't have feelings about themselves, how can they empathize with other people? They can't.
You say that to understand the psychology of violence, we need to turn many of our most basic assumptions about human behavior upside down. What's an example of that?
Well, for example, I think the common sense assumption that has guided our criminal justice policies in this country has been the assumption that violent people act according to rational self-interest, as though they were all graduates of the Harvard Business School and had studied cost-benefit analyses, and that if only we increase the costs of violent behavior, the benefits won't seem quite so desirable. The fact is, these people don't think in those terms. They are totally irrational. If they were interested in rational self-interest, they wouldn't go around getting into so much trouble to begin with. These are people who feel lost, who are so desperate they don't care whether they themselves live or die.
My guest is psychiatrist James Gilligan, author of the book Violence. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. James Gilligan is my guest, and he directed the Center for the Study of Violence at Harvard Medical School, and he's the former director of mental health for the Massachusetts prison system. So these are people who you say have like dead souls. They feel nothing spiritually, even physically. What are some of the conditions that they've been exposed to that have left them feeling dead?
Well, I will tell you, my experience in working with prison inmates over the last 25, almost 30 years has been to give me a whole new concept of what the term child abuse means. It's off the scale to anything I would previously have considered conceivable. The men that I've seen in the prisons who've committed the most terrible violence themselves are often the survivors of attempted murder or of the murders of their closest family members, their brothers or sisters, mothers or fathers. These are men who have been beaten, starved, raped, drugged, suffocated, tortured, thrown out of windows, set on fire, axed, treated in ways that I certainly could not have believed and would not have expected before I started working with them. So I reached the conclusion that the men who are on the, you know, outer extremes of the spectrum of criminal violence as adults were also on the extreme end of the spectrum of violent child abuse as children.
Now, tell me if you think that helps explain a phenomenon that I read so much about. So often I read that somebody killed somebody because the murderer didn't like the way this person looked at them, you know, or the person did some minor trivial thing that the murderer interpreted as a sign of disrespect.
Yes. I can't tell you how often I have had prison inmates tell me when I asked them why they had assaulted somebody that it was because, quote, he disrespected me. Or he disrespected my visitor.
Is there a story that you could tell us about one of the prisoners who you worked with, whose story kind of illustrates the point that you're making about disrespect?
Well, one particular inmate had a powerful impact on me and actually helped me to clarify my understanding of the subject almost more than anybody else. This was a man who had murdered a young woman who had been a high school classmate of his, and he himself was only about 19 at the time. She was about 18. He not only murdered her, but he also cut out her eyes and her tongue. The sheer horror of this just stopped me cold. And I also thought, you know, I had thought I had begun to understand the causes of violence, but this one absolutely stumped me. I was totally stopped. I said, how in the world could I possibly understand such a brutal atrocity? And it was only later in the course of talking with him that I realized the answer, no pun intended, was staring me in the eye. But this man was somebody who felt overwhelmed by feelings of shame and humiliation. He had gone through his childhood, as I learned and as he described to me and to others, being taunted by other people as, quote, a wimp, a punk, and a pussy. We all know what a wimp is. A punk is the prison slang term for the passive homosexual sex object of a more powerful man. And pussy is the slang term, derogatory kind of sexist term for a woman. So this is a man who was saying he felt he was treated as though he was not a man. He was shamed and humiliated. His sense of masculinity was wiped out. His crime, I felt, could only be understandable when we took that psychology into account. Why would he have focused on the eyes and tongue of his victim? I think I've already anticipated the answer. Shame dwells in the eyes. People feel shamed in the eyes of other people if they're visible. It also dwells in the tongue, in the sense that if people are gossiped about, it's through gossiping that people shame each other. There's a folk song that Carl Sandburg, the poet, used to sing, in which a condemned murderer is standing under the gallows about to be lynched for committing a murder. And his song is, my name it is Sam Hall, it is Sam Hall, and I hate you one and all, God damn your eyes. And that song, which Eric Erickson quotes in his discussions of shame, to me, finally made sense of this murderer. The psychology going on was a kind of very primitive physical logic, which was, if I wipe out eyes and tongues, then I cannot be shamed. I can wipe out shame, because I can only be shamed in the eyes and tongues of other people.
So it seems that one thing that the profiles of many murderers have in common is the sense that that they've been shamed. And that they're yes. really lacking in self-esteem. So does murder increase a killer's self-esteem?
Fortunately or unfortunately, it is primarily a self-defeating policy. I'd say it, if it works at all, it's only in the sense that drinking salt water, you know, as a method of trying to alleviate thirst, works but doesn't work. The people that I've seen don't feel better afterwards. And in fact, one reason that serial murderers commit serial murder is again, it's like the psychology of drinking salt water to alleviate thirst. It doesn't work. It's self-defeating. And that's why, as I said earlier, so many murderers follow up the act of murder with a suicide. They discover that nothing is going to enable them to feel good about themselves. Nothing is going to heal the what analysts call the narcissistic wounds that they suffered earlier in their lives.
But they may think that murder will help. They maybe believe before the act of murder that murder might help them feel, that murder might boost their self-esteem.
Yes. That is an illusion that murderers suffer from, which is why they commit murder, and then they discover it doesn't work. It's also an illusion that people who believe in capital punishment suffer from, when they assume the capital punishment will help them to feel better. And as Sister Helen Prejean pointed out in her book on capital punishment recently, Dead Man Walking, that doesn't work either. She describes people, the families of people who've been murdered, who continue to feel, even after the murderer was executed, that they wanted him to be executed again, or executed more slowly, or executed more painfully. None of us, it doesn't work. There's no end to revenge.
Dr. James Gilligan is a psychiatrist who teaches at Harvard Medical School. He's former director of mental health for the Massachusetts prison system and author of the book Violence. Our interview was recorded last April. We'll continue our examination of the minds of murderers on the second half of our show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.